America's first cultural export, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The political meltdown in Virginia has restarted America's uncomfortable conversation about blackface and racism. It turns out blackface is also a global conversation.
Blackface minstrelsy was actually America's first popular culture export.
Also today, an Iranian activist message to the United States.
My people are not the people chanting death to America. My people do not want military action, and my people do not deserve to be sanctioned. Instead, you have to sanction the Revolutionary Guard.
Plus, you'd be surprised how much senior citizens in Finland know about artificial intelligence.
I thought that maybe they don't know that much, but this is not true. They know a lot.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The first week of Black History Month has been a long year. That tweet I saw earlier today was referring to the controversy in Virginia that is not dying down. Democratic Governor Ralph Northam refuses to resign after admitting to wearing blackface in college. The state's attorney general admits he did it too. If you think America's troubled past and present with race makes blackface a uniquely white American thing, you'd be mistaken. We begin today on The World looking at how blackface reinforces damaging stereotypes in many places around the globe. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
In the Netherlands, on the 5th day of December, Santa arrives with a helper. His name, translated to English, is Black Pete. If kids have been bad, Black Pete kidnaps them. In parades, he's usually a white man in blackface.
All those people who have a problem with Black Pete, it's our tradition. Leave it alone. You have your tradition, so why can't we?
Spain also has a Christmas-themed example. There's a tradition of white people painting their faces black to portray one of the three wise men. That also happens in Germany. During Persian New Year, parades traditionally feature Haji Fidus, a cheerful figure who's usually played by someone in blackface. America began to influence the rest of the world's view of blackface in the 1800s.
Blackface minstrelsy was actually America's first popular culture export.
Chinua Thelwell teaches history and Africana studies at the College of William and Mary. He says a man named Thomas Dartmouth Rice first brought American minstrel shows to Europe in 1836. White performers portrayed African-American slaves in tattered clothes, dancing and singing songs like this one, Jump Jim Crow.
And then from there, the culture spread out to other places.
Blackface minstrels toured Australia, India, South America, South Africa. They were seen as American and therefore exotic, Thelwell says. The shows passed on ideas and images to other cultures, and then they manifested themselves in new ways, like Memín Pingüín, an enduring Mexican comic book character created in the 1940s. He's a black boy with monkey-like features. Thelwell says minstrel shows and their cultural descendants reinforced oppression. They confirmed white people's racist belief that black people weren't civilized enough to be treated as equals.
Oftentimes, the humor in blackface minstrel shows portrayed black characters as non-citizens who were unfit for democratic participation. And oftentimes, that humor would set up situations where whenever black characters tried to be modern citizens, they would fail and fail comically.
White people started questioning blackface during the civil rights movement, Thelwell says. By the 1970s, Britain's popular BBC TV program, The Black and White Minstrel Show, with its blackface song and dance numbers, was forced off the air.
The Black and White Minstrel Show!
But still, there were many British viewers who wanted it to continue. It was eventually revived for a couple years. There were like these holiday episodes. And the last televised broadcast of the Black and White Minstrel Show was 1978.
After that, examples of people doing blackface popped up once in a while in the news. People would usually try it on Halloween. In Australia, in 2009, Harry Connick Jr. was judging a TV talent show when he was presented with a group of singers in blackface.
And I just wanted to say on behalf of, you know, of my country, I know it was done in humorously, but, you know, we've spent so much time trying to not make black people look like buffoons, that when we see something like that, we take it really to heart.
In 2017, a Malaysian beauty store chain apologized after putting out a TV commercial about a prince who falls for a woman's voice. When they meet for the first time, the woman tests the prince's sincerity by appearing in blackface. He's shocked. In 2018, China's Lunar New Year TV show was criticized for a skit that featured a woman in blackface with an exaggerated rear end. And in Kuwait, a TV actor apologized for appearing in a show with blackface to portray Sudanese people.
It's like the, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Mia Moody Ramirez is a Baylor University professor who wrote a book called From Blackface to Black Twitter. She says she's not sure if there are more instances of blackface happening or if the news is just covering them more.
Having the coverage in social media platforms, that really increases the need to cover it.
And social media is global. Movements go international now because of social media, like Me Too and Black Lives Matter. People everywhere can weigh in when something happens anywhere. Moody Ramirez has never seen this many reported instances of blackface.
I would say we definitely reached a tipping point now that we're talking about it more and dedicating more time to the topic. People in the future will definitely know that it's wrong.
And she thinks that means fewer people will make the mistake of doing it. But right now, it seems to be everywhere. This week, news hit that the Italian brand Gucci was selling a black sweater that covers the bottom of a wearer's face and has a cutout with big red lips. Gucci had to apologize after complaints. So from Santa's helper in the Netherlands to a Lunar New Year comedian in China, it seems like the argument that blackface is a harmless tradition is losing ground. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
This week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with a women's rights activist from Iran, and it's causing a backlash for the activists in question. Masih Alinejad is her name. She lives in the U.S. now. Some of the backlash she's been getting online appears to be coming from inside Iran. One tweet, for example, asks accusingly, "How could you dare even imagining that you are the voice of Iranian people?" So she clearly touched a nerve by agreeing to meet with a high-ranking U.S. official. Today, we asked her to share her reasons for meeting with Secretary Pompeo.
So I made 3 points in this meeting. First, I said in the 40th anniversary of the Islamic Republic, there are a significant number of Iranian people. They don't want the Islamic Republic. And when they take to the street, they get killed. Only last year, there were 7,000 people got arrested, according to Amnesty International, and 20 people got killed, according to Amnesty International, and they never had the chance to be heard around the world. And the second point that I made was about Iranian people do not have a free election. So when we don't have free election, then they have to recognize the voice of those people who want a free election in Iran. And third point, I talked about travel ban, which hurts Iranian people itself and human rights activists and students, not the, you know, government of Iran.
So what kind of responses have you been getting from people in Iran to that meeting with Pompeo?
If you go to my Instagram, this picture has more likes than ever, and it has 19,000 messages. And so many people supported my meeting.
There are also a lot of people who have criticized that meeting that you took with Pompeo.
So these people who criticized me, these are the reformist people. These are the people who voted for the people who've been in charge for killing, you know, Iranian oppositions. And that people criticized me without even paying attention to my position in this meeting.
There's also another group of critics, Masih Alinejad, that are concerned that your advocacy for women's rights and equality in Iran might actually empower the Trump administration's Iran policy, that you're being co-opted by people like Mike Pompeo. What do you say to that?
That's a good question. Thank you for asking that. But let me make it clear for you. How come when a powerful woman like me go to the office of Secretary of State and saying that loud, My people are not the one burning the flag of America. My people are not the people chanting death to America. My people do not want military action, and my people do not deserve to be sanctioned. Instead, you have to sanction the Revolutionary Guard. You have to sanction the Iranian state television, and you have to ban the Iranian officials who torture us.
Ultimately, with this meeting with Mike Pompeo and these three important points where you were making, ultimately, is the end goal for you regime change?
My goal, which I mentioned in this meeting, to have a free election, to have a referendum where people inside Iran can make decision about the future of the Islamic Republic. So I never ask any Western country to come and overthrow the regime.
I mentioned that Masih Alinejad is facing a backlash for meeting with Pompeo. To understand why, we contacted Nigar Mortazavi. She's an Iranian journalist with the British newspaper The Independent. She's in Washington today. Nigar, how do you see a meeting between someone like Masih Alinejad and a high-ranking U.S. official like Mike Pompeo?
Well, I don't think meetings in their essence are bad things, but we have to see the outcome of that meeting and the way these meetings are set up. It just seems like this was more of a photo op for the State Department, for Mike Pompeo, and the U.S. is trying to use the issue of human rights and women's rights in Iran and weaponize that, not just against the Iranian government, but even against its own allies in Europe, to put more pressure on them to even try to have them pull out of the nuclear deal. So it seems like this was more of a situation where the State Department is using Iranian activists to give credibility to their policies against not just the Iranian government, in fact, the Iranian public.
Why do you think there has been such an uproar in Iran about Masih's meeting and outside of Iran, too? I mean, what nerve did she hit?
I think it's because Mike Pompeo is not seen as a friend of the Iranian people. He has proven, not just this administration, but Secretary Pompeo himself has proven that women's rights and human rights is not really his issue and priority and something that he cares about. For example, if treating U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia, there was a journalist just chopped up with orders of the Saudi government, their women's rights activists in jail, the reports of their torture. And we see Secretary of State doing photo ops with the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia and doing business as normal as this administration is pursuing. So that gives Iranians, because Iranians, even inside Iran, follow these things, that gives them the impression that human rights is not really something this administration cares about, even if they say it's something they are. They're imposing these sanctions, they've imposed this travel ban. They've time and again proved that that's not their priority.
Nigar, at the end of the day, how worried are you that an Iranian activist for women's rights, not known to many Americans, could actually somehow weaponize Trump's Iran policy?
I think it's worrisome. I honestly don't think this is a very important step. I feel like this administration has made its decisions, although the majority of the Iranians, even Iranian Americans, have been polled, and the majority of them, they don't want to see the government, the U.S. government, go down a path of war and military conflict, which would hurt their loved ones back in Iran. So if you are giving ammunition to the administration to go down that road, that's worrisome. But I don't think this is the major step. It seems like this administration has already made its decision of going down that path, and it's just using these secondary issues on the side.
Nigar Mortazavi with the British newspaper The Independent, speaking with us from Washington. Thank you, Nigar.
Thank you.
Recruiting senior citizens in Finland to teach others about artificial intelligence. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you know Tim Hortons, you know they are to Canada what Dunkin' Donuts is to us here in New England. Tim Horton himself was a famous hockey player, but the king of this Canadian coffee and donut empire was a man named Ron Joyce. Joyce died yesterday, aged 88. He grew up poor and made his fortune and reputation as a ruthless businessman. He did give part of his wealth to helping kids. The Tim Horton Children's Foundation, for example, runs a network of summer camps for underprivileged kids. Might not sound like much until you start to speak with some of their alumni. Sheila Cole is one of them.
I grew up in a big city just outside of Toronto called Mississauga. My parents split when I was really young, and I was primarily raised by my mom. And, you know, and she had an undesirable youth herself, and there wasn't a lot of resources available. I grew up in a house with three of my five siblings. we were low income. You know, we had a level of dysfunction and we needed support. We were actually, when I was 7, I was enrolled into the Big Brothers Big Sisters program. And through that program was introduced to the Tim Hortons camp and be exposed to fun and childhood and adventures. It was pretty incredible.
So this new sense of kind of fun and enjoying your childhood at this camp, I mean, that mm-hmm. was kind of in contrast to what you were living in Mississauga. I mean, because weren't you like living by yourself at some point in your teens?
Yeah. So in my teens, it was pretty, there was quite a few challenges that I faced. My dad passed away when I was 14 and I didn't really get to know him as well as I wish I had. My sister ran away from home and then I too at 16 was living on my own in an apartment. And yeah, I had to grow up really fast.
So you go to this camp that Ron Joyce founded, the Tim Hortons camp. I mean, was there an experience that you remember at camp that kind of stayed with you? And maybe looking back at it now, you see a useful life lesson.
Many. Like, they had a leadership program, and they still have that. And it's really strategically developed. And it's 10 days at camp, but 6 of those days you spend on a canoe trip. And you portage canoes, you're paddling for kilometers at a time. You know, I'm a very small girl. I'm, as an adult now, even just 110 pounds, but I, you know, portaged a canoe by myself for 10 kilometers.
Wow.
And which is incredible and such a huge accomplishment for a kid. But beyond that is you just feel like, wow, I just did something I didn't think I could. And you start to believe in yourself, you know?
Yeah.
One thing that I absolutely didn't like is having people feel sorry for me. And there was not a time at camp that I felt that the counselors felt sorry for us.
I mean, that's a really powerful lesson. But I'm wondering, do you connect those lessons to Tim Hortons Donuts and Ron Joyce?
Absolutely. I am the camp. Is the life lessons that they teach you. Like I said, it's very strategically developed and they're empowering you and they're encouraging you. And I'm a mom. So those are things that I do with my children. I'm giving them a voice, which is something that the camp is at the top of their priority list, is making you feel like you're valuable. And then also teaching you, life skills, like what you need to enter the workforce. They help you build a resume. They help you, you know, look for bursaries to go to college and university and some things that you didn't think. And these are skills that I was able to, you know, continue to use in my life, but I'll also be able to continue to use going forward with my own kids.
That's really cool. So apparently you survived childhood. What are you?
I did.
What are you doing now?
I am actually a nurse at the local hospital. I'm a mom to 2 little girls. I'm a wife to a pilot. I'm busy, but I'm very happy. And I look at my life sometimes and I recognize how fortunate I am and how beautiful my life has become.
Sheila Cole, nurse, mother, really appreciate your taking the time to share your thoughts about the late Ron Joyce of Tim Hortons Donuts and how his philanthropic work helped change your life. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Artificial intelligence, AI, it can sound like this futuristic, even scary thing, but a lot of us already use apps and gadgets powered by AI, Siri and Alexa, to name 2, both running on artificial intelligence. Finland is trying to educate its citizens about those practical uses of AI, specifically its senior citizens. The world's Lydia Emanalidou with that story.
In many ways, Helulu is your typical grandma. She's retired, spends a lot of her time taking care of her grandchildren.
I also sing in a chorus. I like fitness exercises. And I'm a part of a book club, so I read a lot.
These days, she's got a new gig as an AI evangelist.
AI is now my new hobby.
It's a volunteering gig, part of Finland's national plan to keep its citizens tech savvy. Helu first had to learn the basics of AI, the ethics, and even some programming. And now she teaches it to other seniors at community centers and libraries.
I had certain bias, I think, before I started to discuss with seniors. I thought that maybe they don't know that much, but this is not true. They know a lot.
I think it's really great to have the seniors teaching each other, because then everybody learns at the same time from each other.
Taru Tuomala works at a senior center that recently hosted one of these training sessions.
And they had these small robots, and they had a Tai Chi lesson, small Tai Chi lesson.
Wait, so they did a Tai Chi lesson with the robot?
Yeah, the robot did a Tai Chi lesson.
Was it a big, like, was it a big robot or a small robot?
Quite small. It was standing on the table. Then there were the teacher said that maybe we should go now. And the robot said that, yes, okay, but can you hold my hand? And then they hold hands with the teacher and the robot and walked away. And everyone was like, oh, this is so cute.
Finland's not trying to become a global AI superpower. Instead, it wants its citizens to know and use AI in practical ways. Finland's offering a free online course through a university, and they want at least 1% of Finns to take it. Their hope is that Finns will have fluency with artificial intelligence and that they'll help shape the country's policies in the future. And Helulu agrees that senior citizens, like her 80-year-old mother, shouldn't be left behind.
I have seen how difficult it is to live in this society if you don't use digital services.
Banking, apps, communication, they're all changing because of AI. And now Helu isn't just helping her elderly mother keep up. She says her own adult kids and her grandkids are coming to her to learn all about AI. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
I'm Marco Werman. A musicologist from Ukraine finally gets his due decades after his death.
You know, this guy, he dies in 1961 thinking that nobody will ever need anything that he has collected. And then this is a Grammy thing.
Drake, Lady Gaga, look out for Yiddish glory at the Grammys. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Oscar Arias, Nobel Peace Prize winner, two-time president of Costa Rica, widely seen as an international leader of peace, now accused of sexually assaulting five women. Yesterday, we spoke with Emma Daly, one of the women who spoke out against Arias.
Women like me, who have the sort of privilege and the security to be able to stand up and speak out, ought to do so, because there are so many other women who really aren't in that kind of position.
That got us thinking about this Me Too moment and a version of it that's now active in Costa Rica. Ari Reyes is the director of a women's rights group in Costa Rica called Peras del Olmo. Ari, what did you think when you heard about the accusations against Oscar Arias, your former president?
I haven't stopped reacting. We keep hearing more and more different allegations over social media, and some are getting media coverage in general. This is not unlike what we've seen happen in the US or other countries, where different forms of violence against women are increasing in numbers and getting more coverage. When it comes to the way we experience violence, the way we report it, and the way we receive justice or vindications, the odds have been historically against women. So I wholeheartedly wish recent events are a sign that those tides are turning.
So how is this playing out on social media? Are people sharing their opinions? Are women sharing Me Too stories at this point, or maybe under a different hashtag that's being used in Costa Rica?
We are seeing women sharing more stories related to Oscar Arias and their experiences with him. But we are also seeing women in general just sharing their stories, some maybe for the first time. We are seeing a lot of women coming forward in social media. We're not using the Me Too hashtag. The one that has gotten traction in Costa Rica is the Yo Te Creo, or I Believe You hashtag.
The Me Too movement emerged in the U.S., as you know, a little more than 2 years ago, and it spread fast internationally. Was Me Too a conversation in Costa Rica then, when it started here?
I believe that it was inevitably a conversation in organizations such as mine or groups that are already involved in women's rights. But I did not think it created such a large echo as it is right now when we are living something similar in our own context.
Right. I'm curious, too, how does this healthy machismo culture in Latin America affect this conversation, or how has it affected the conversation for women in Costa Rica?
When women speak up, when they do this admirable act of courage, of telling their story, they're just being attacked, judged, re-victimized, unfairly scrutinized. We live in a culture that pervasively turns questions towards the victim and not the abuser. And we don't hear enough questions about, could this allegation be true? What does it mean if this abuse takes place? And we do not hold the perpetrator accountable.
So step back, if you would, Ari Reyes, and just what is the level of sexual assault and sexual harassment in Costa Rica? How big a problem is it?
It's hard to dimension this problem with numbers because so few women come forward. We need to understand the context of Latin America. Just recently, I believe it was Eugenia Pisa Lopez from the United Nations Gender Mission in Latin America was quoted saying that the issue of violence against women in general in Latin America is critical. It's the most violent region in the world against women outside of conflict contexts. One of the main focuses of my organization is sexual harassment in public spaces. And in that area, we count that 9 out of 10 women report a harassment experience in public spaces. And 7 out of 10 women have been groped in the streets. Women's bodies are still generally perceived as public domain objects.
And those statistics apply specifically to Costa Rica?
Yes, those are specifically our country.
So where does this Me Too moment in Costa Rica go from here? Do you think these high-profile cases make people more likely to stand up and speak out, like the Oscar Arias charges?
I think that, as you may be well aware, Oscar Arias is a very prominent public figure in our context. So what I'd like to believe is that if allegations are coming forth against him, any victim of sexual harassment out there can say, if allegations can be brought up against him, maybe I can tell my story against my abuser. I'm hoping this sends a message out there to other women saying even people in high places can be held accountable for their actions. So maybe I, too, can share my story.
Ari Reyes in San Jose, Costa Rica. She's the director of the women's rights group, Peras del Olmo. Thank you very much for your time and your thoughts.
Thank you for having me, Marco. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
The accusations against Oscar Arias obviously damage his reputation, but what does it say about the Nobel Peace Prize itself? For that, we reached out to Jody Williams. She won the Peace Prize in 1997 for her work eradicating landmines. Here's Jody.
Oh, it's so complicated, of course. I know Oscar. I'm not usually speechless, believe me. The Nobel Women's Initiative, of which I am the chair, is shocked. I'm shocked. And since it is in court, we believe that Oscar has the right to be investigated and we'll watch the outcome. Larger than that, though, is the issue of women speaking out and what happens to them when they do. Inevitably called liars, that they have some sort of nefarious goal in mind. For me, when Emma Daly of Human Rights Watch and the other women spoke out in support of the woman who, you know, has brought a criminal complaint against Mr. Arias, I think they're brave. And I think that it's amazing when women are willing to put themselves out there in support of other women.
Well, Aung San Suu Kyi is not part of that Nobel Women's Initiative. We spoke with you back in 2017 when Myanmar's military began a campaign against the Rohingya ethnic minority there. And you had some criticism for Aung San Suu Kyi, the de facto leader of Myanmar. Here's that clip.
She allowed the international community to hold her up as a beacon of democracy and an icon of human rights. I've paid close attention to her actions since she's been the de facto head of government, and she is not acting like a beacon of hope for democracy in my book, nor is she protecting the human rights of all of the people of Burma, Myanmar.
So Jody Williams, that was you in 2017, I know it's not a great comparison, but both Oscar Arias and Aung San Suu Kyi have been widely criticized internationally, obviously for different reasons, since winning the prize. Do you think that dilutes our status as winners of the Nobel Peace Prize?
In the case of Aung San Suu Kyi, definitely. In the case of Oscar Arias and the allegations against him, to me that's different in terms of the work he did as a Nobel laureate. I think people confuse receiving the Nobel Peace Prize with suddenly becoming a sainted human being. Mm. It doesn't recognize your internal being. It's a recognition of the work that you and or people you work with, as in my case, have done to try to diminish militaristic tendencies in the world. And for sure, Oscar Arias has done that in his life and in that sense is deserving of the Peace Prize. That does not change the fact that he is being charged with sexual harassment and assault. But the work he did help out the situation of Central America.
Couldn't you say the same for Aung San Suu Kyi, though?
No, because it's not like she's doing something to an individual person. It is her entire being that she is lending to, in my view, genocide of the Rohingya and being extremely hard when people call her on it. The Peace Prize is about peace, and genocide is not about peace. So I truly believe in her case, it's very different.
I guess what I'd love to know, Jody Williams, is what does the prize then mean to you? And should it recognize strictly the work of the recipients and kind of nothing else?
I mean, I don't think it is a morality prize, but I certainly would not want to see it be given to someone who is demonstrably immoral or amoral, as in the case, in my view, of Henry Kissinger, which almost blew up the Nobel Committee when that recognition went to him, by the way.
It's interesting you mentioned Kissinger. There does seem to be a kind of inconsistency in the whole Nobel Peace Prize process. I mean, your work certainly seems worthy, but then you compare it with a Henry Kissinger or an Obama who got it before he had really done anything as president, or why Martin Luther King Jr. got one and Gandhi didn't. Are we equating the prize and its recipient with a kind of purity?
I'm not pure. And when I received the Peace Prize, I did not become pure, believe me. I am still the same fun-loving Jody Williams I've always been. But the work that we did was worthy of that recognition. In a Henry Kissinger case, I mean, he was clearly involved in the dirty wars of the Southern Cone. He ordered the Christmas bombings in Vietnam, Cambodia. How could you award a Peace Prize to that kind of human? And in my view, in that case, when actions are directly contradictory to what the Peace Prize is supposed to be about, they should not receive the prize. In the case of Aung San Suu Kyi, she did not reveal herself until she attained power. Hindsight is brilliant, and it makes me kind of want to go and take the flower out of her hair.
The Nobel Prize Committee currently cannot rescind an award. Do you know why that is, and do you think that should be an option in the future?
Boy, that'd be a hornet's nest. You know, their mandate is to recognize people and or institutions that have contributed to peace in one way or another. It's not their job after the fact to go back and assess them and put them on trial. You know, that's the International Criminal Court or public opinion. I don't think it's the Nobel Committee's duty to take back the prize, but I think it would be very powerful. It would require certainly setting up requirements that must be met in order to rescind a prize. Theoretically, I kind of like that idea, actually.
Jody Williams received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997 and is part of the Nobel Women's Initiative. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
When a country recalls its ambassador, it is a big deal diplomatically. It means a major break in the relationship of two nations. This week, France recalled its ambassador to Italy, creating, some say, the worst crisis between the two countries since World War II. The government of President Emmanuel Macron says Italian leaders are interfering in French domestic politics after Italian Deputy Prime Minister Luigi Di Maio met with yellow vest protesters, Gilets Jaunes, in Paris. To understand the stakes of the situation, we turn to Mario Del Perro, an Italian history professor at Sciences Po in Paris. He says he's concerned, but not surprised.
I think there is a short-term electoral convenience. attacking Macron, visiting Paris, meeting with the Gilets Jaunes and the Italian Vice Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister Luigi Di Maio. He met with Christophe Chalençon, who is one of the most radical, extreme members of the Gilets Jaunes, someone who called for a civil war in the country. Well, doing all of this is a way to gain some easy electoral points in the forthcoming vote for the European Parliament. It represents, however, visible interference in the domestic affairs of another country, of a key ally, of a member of the European Union, of a member of NATO, is something highly unusual and ultimately unacceptable, as Macron has made clear.
Yeah, and in that sense, I want to know what you think about this kind of big headline that, you know, the two countries' diplomatic relations haven't been this bad since World War II. I mean, it sounds like this is serious, but perhaps more melodrama than, you know, this existential fight between fascism and a free Europe.
Yeah, we are not in the spring of 1940. Fortunately, that's the last time the French ambassador was recalled after the Italian declaration of war. But that the European government, one of the most important European governments, that of France, decides to recall the ambassador from another major European country, well, that gives us an idea of the crisis Europe is facing, and also of the return, unexpected and somehow disturbing, of a sort of hyper-nationalism, which is very visible in the case of Italy. Italy has long been a very pro-European, pro-EC, pro-EU country, which in the last few years has undergone a major change, political, but one could say also public, in the political culture of the country. And nowadays, this kind of hyper-nationalist line and message, they seem to be predominant. The majority in Italy seems to appreciate this kind of line. And as I say, it's very disturbing because Europe, which is facing multiple arcs of crisis, immigration is just one of them, Europe needs anything but a return of intra-European conflicts and tensions.
Mario Del Paro, professor of international history at Sciences Po in Paris. Thanks very much for your time and for explaining this all.
Thanks for having me.
One story dominated the news in Thailand today about a princess who is running for public office. The World's Patrick Nguyen explains from Bangkok.
Thai people woke up this morning to a huge political shock. A princess, the sister of Thailand's king, running for prime minister.
Sawasdee ka.
There's an election coming up in Thailand in about a month, and everyone was wondering who the different parties' candidates would be. Well, she said, I am one of the candidates. Royalty in Thailand are not supposed to get involved in politics. It's considered dirty, and royalty is considered sacrosanct. So everybody has been speculating about this all day long. The princess's name is Ubanlat, and she is the king's sister. She's actually his oldest sister. And if you ask most people in Thailand what they think about this princess, they'll say, oh, she's the fun princess. She's very extroverted. She's been in action movies. And then more recently, she got on stage and sang what is probably the most popular pop song in Thailand right now. It's called Fortune Cookie by a girl group called BNK48. She gets up there, she's 67 years old, she sings the song, knocks it out, and everyone just eats it up. So she's very popular, she's seen as an entertaining, extroverted figure in Thailand. But she has not been seen as a political figure, as far as someone who's going out and articulating grand policy proposals. So it really came out of the blue. A lot of people didn't think it was actually going to happen. Well, it did, almost. Close to midnight here in Thailand, this day-long speculation that the princess could be prime minister just completely went up in smoke. The king of Thailand, who is unimpeachable, you can't criticize him by law, he comes out and says, my sister can't run for office. in Thailand, there is no going rogue, going against the word of the king, but a lot remains to be seen and a lot can happen in the next month before the election.
Now you know. The world's Patrick Wynn there reporting from Bangkok. Tune into the Grammy Awards this Sunday night and you'll hear big name nominees Lady Gaga, Cardi B, Drake.
I've been moving calm, don't start no trouble with me. Trying to keep it peaceful is a struggle for me.
Also seeking some hardware at this year's Grammys, a collection of tunes written by a group of unknown Yiddish songwriters. Yiddish Glory, The Lost Songs of World War II is the name of the album, nominated in the world music category, which makes me really wonder what world music means anymore. Anyway, this album is a collection of new recordings of old lost songs written by Jews, primarily from the ghettos of Ukraine.
Unser Mazel, unser Leben.
I thought this material was so shattering, it gave me goosebumps to think about the songs.
That's Anna Sternschiss, professor at the University of Toronto. Anna curated the Yiddish Glory album. She tracked down the songs on it 18 years ago. They were locked in an archive in Kiev. And before that, we're about to clear up that mystery. Remember this name, though, Moisey Beregovsky. He was an ethnomusicologist who preserved the songs before Anna did.
Most of the songs were just lyrics, but some had the musical charts, handwritten.
Wow.
But often they didn't finish this work, so they wrote annotations saying, like, sang to a famous Soviet song, but wouldn't say which one, which was sort of helpful when you want to sing it today, but not exactly.
Right. So before you found the songs in the archive in Kiev, where had they been hiding? Or were they in the archive all these years since the war?
Well, when Beregovsky and his team were arrested, the archive was seized by the Soviet secret police called NKVD. And it was stored somewhere there. I don't know where exactly. But in the 70s, they quietly moved these documents without a catalog, without any identification, into the basement of the Ukrainian National Library. The temperature was right, the conditions were right, so the papers survived. This is a huge deal.
Yeah, that's kind of a miracle, isn't it?
A miracle and tribute to those librarians. In the 1990s, when the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, they opened those boxes, and that's when they found these documents written in Yiddish. A librarian named Mila Sholokhova made the first catalog. It was another miracle that she, living in Ukraine at the time, could read Yiddish. And after she did this, she left, and now she lives in New York and the head of Yiva Archive. But that's how these materials came back.
What an amazing story.
These songs tell experiences of Soviet Jews during the war. 2.5 million Jews were killed in the Soviet Union. They were usually not deported to any places that we know today, like Auschwitz and other death centers in Poland. But they were killed right where they lived. And sometimes the German army would invade. A few weeks later, they would kill all the Jews right there in ravines and all this.
Well, so Babi Yar, the famous story just outside of Kiev.
Exactly. And yeah. We have a song about Babi Yar. But there are also less famous ravines like Kamenetsk Podolsk, where 8,000 Jews were killed in July 1941. We have songs written days before that. Then we have songs written by the Red Army soldiers, who, you know, Yiddish speakers were drafted. 500,000 Jews served in the Red Army. Some of them spoke Yiddish, and it turns out some of them were singing in Yiddish as well. Some volunteer Red Army officers and soldiers collected the songs. They ended up in that archive. So the whole history of Soviet Jews during the war is in those songs.
So we'll obviously have to see if Yiddish Glory gets a Grammy, but the nomination alone, what does that mean to you?
I thought about Moisey Beregovsky, and I thought about him, you know, this guy, an ethnomusicologist, brilliant, brilliant scholar. He dies in 1961 thinking that nobody will ever need anything that he has collected. And then this is a Grammy thing happened. And I was thinking that it's fair Not for me, of course not, but it is fair for this guy, for Berezovsky, who didn't give up and who got rewarded, although he can't see it, unfortunately.
Anna Sternschies, who led the Grammy-nominated recording project Yiddish Glory, The Lost Songs of World War II. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yiddish Glory, going for Grammy Glory this Sunday. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We're back on the radio on Monday. Always online at theworld.org. You have a great weekend.
Seit kommen euch die Ende von Leiden und von Pein. Hotel sie wird ihr klappen und kritzen mit die Zehn. Was ihr sind da so schlecht mit uns gewesen. Da klappt der Gloss und Gläser.
PRI, Public Radio International.